Hello, I'm Julian Warwicker. Thank you for downloading the BBC World Tonight podcast for Monday the 25th of November. The Israeli Security Cabinet will meet tomorrow to discuss approving a ceasefire with Hezbollah. We'll examine the details of a possible deal and ask why, if the reports are right, the Israeli Prime Minister, Mr. Netanyahu, is backing it in principle. We hear the arguments that will be aired in the UK Supreme Court, scrutinising the law in Scotland relating to the definition of a woman. And the music producer Trevor Horn reflects on the part he played in the Band-Aid single of 40 years ago and how he's remixed a new version for now. We begin with developments in the Middle East, where it seems a ceasefire deal is possible, which could end the fighting between Israel and the Iranian-backed Lebanese militia Hezbollah. According to both Israeli and US officials, the Israeli cabinet is due to meet tomorrow to discuss it. There's talk of a 60-day truce, at least initially, and then the withdrawal of Israeli forces from southern Lebanon and an end to the Hezbollah presence in the area. All this comes after a weekend of violence which certainly didn't indicate that a ceasefire was on the cards. That was an Israeli strike earlier today on Beirut's southern suburbs. It's an area which has been repeatedly struck since September the 23rd, when Israel intensified its air campaign, targeting Hezbollah not just in the capital, but also in Lebanon's east and south. It later sent ground troops into southern Lebanon. There have also been Hezbollah rocket strikes into Israel in recent hours. That was a direct hit yesterday on a building in Nahariya, close to the Lebanese border. While there's been an intensification in the exchange of fire between Israel and Hezbollah, the two sides have been in negotiations too. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is said to have agreed to the deal in principle, and the Lebanese Deputy Parliament Speaker Elias Boussab said there were now no serious obstacles to a ceasefire. Matthew Miller, U.S. State Department spokesman, had this view from the Americans.
There have been many times when we thought we were going to be getting to yes in both cases, and for various reasons, the parties didn't get there. That said, we believe we are close here, but that's why you heard me come out and say nothing's final until everything is final, because we know we don't have a deal until there's one that has been fully agreed to by both sides.
Well, earlier I spoke to Lebanon's finance minister, Youssef Khalil. I asked him if he thought a ceasefire deal was close.
I think the United Nations are very serious. Is it that the UN can satisfy that need, that both parties respected and both parties can achieve what they think they're good at achieving?
Why do you think we've got to this point now?
Perhaps this is a good timing to say, well, the Hezbollah has proven itself. The Israelis more or less want to stop.
One of the issues that we're told is in these proposals is that the Lebanese military would significantly boost its presence close to the border with Israel once Hezbollah have removed their fighters and weapons from that area. Is the Lebanese military ready to perform that kind of action?
Yes, if they're presented as such, if the agenda is there, yes, they are capable of doing this, especially that they are helped and treated and respected by bigger nations, given that the Hezbollah would give its weapons to the army.
Well, that's another important point, isn't it, in terms of international trust. Can we believe that Hezbollah would give up their weapons and remove their fighters from that area? Do you trust them to do that in these circumstances?
I would say, given the expectations of people from all confessions, yes, I think it will be welcomed by people. And second, it was put in the newspaper on more than one occasion that the 1701 would be met by Hezbollah.
That's the UN resolution relating to southern Lebanon.
The way it's going to go is very transparent. You can start to see it within a week or so, or 10 days or so. Is everybody respecting the 1701 or are they not?
So what's changed at the top of Israeli politics to make a ceasefire deal possible, even likely, between Israel and Hezbollah? Noga Tanopolsky is a freelance journalist based in Jerusalem.
I'm hearing that we're closer than we ever have been since the start of the war. And the start of the war on Israel's northern front was on October 8th, 2023. We're hearing numerous things. We're hearing that Prime Minister Netanyahu himself has made a decision to go for this, and he has been operating more and more autonomously. So although his ministers have to vote on this tomorrow, they have yet to even see the text of the agreement.
If Mr. Netanyahu has shifted along the lines you've described, why is he shifting now?
This war cannot last forever, and Israeli society and the Israeli army is beginning to fray at the edges. So the army favors this deal, and the response to military conscription of the reservists, that is the bulk of the Israeli army, is down from 115%, which it was at the beginning, to around 80-85% now. It just can't be sustained. There's another wound that he needs to try and fix, and it's that between 60 and 80,000 Israelis remain displaced persons because they can't live in their homes in the north of the country after 14 months. The problem with this agreement is that it's unclear that it offers a solution for those internally displaced people or for businesses that have gone under in front. It's unclear that it offers protection to Israelis beyond the 60-day limit of the agreement. And so his ministers are fearful of supporting it and then looking like fools.
What of the most hawkish elements of Mr. Netanyahu's coalition cabinet, many of whom would perhaps rail against this? Do we know where they are?
Yes, absolutely. The Minister of Internal Security, Itamar Ben-Gvir, one of the extremists you're referring to, has already said he won't vote for it. He also has not seen the text yet. Finance Minister was another extremist member of this coalition. He won't vote for it. More interestingly, several members of Netanyahu's own Likud party who are in cabinet say they're not sure they'll vote for it. And one has said flat out that he won't vote for it. So Netanyahu is in a weaker position in his cabinet than he thought he would be, because there's a very deep thirst for an end to the war. But it simply hasn't been explained to Israelis in such a way that anyone really believes this will materially improve the situation.
And that's the test of it in political terms, isn't it? In terms of how it's sold to the Israeli public and how it can be portrayed as a victory.
That's right. I think there are two things that Netanyahu could do that would really hand him a victory now, the sort of victory he needs. And this doesn't achieve any of them. He will not be able to tell the residents of Israel's north that they can go back home. That has already been leaked today. The other victory image which Netanyahu has failed to achieve is that of bringing the hostages back home from Gaza. While all eyes are on a Lebanon deal, it's true that fewer people are thinking of Gaza, but this is an open wound in Israeli society, and the families of these hostages have demanded all along, as soon as it became clear that Netanyahu was aiming first for a ceasefire on the northern border before the southern border, they demanded that the two be linked. And so this unlinking of the two fronts of this one war is really heartbreaking and terrifying to a big chunk of society that keeps waiting to see the Israelis who are still hostages come back home.
Noga Tanopolsky in Jerusalem. Now, when the Gender Representation on Public Boards Scotland Act was passed by the Scottish Parliament in 2018, it set a 50% target for the number of women on public boards in Scotland. So far, so uncontroversial. Since then, the definition of a woman in this context has led to a series of legal challenges, and the debate has heated up significantly as a result. Well, that's taken matters to the UK Supreme Court tomorrow, where an appeal by the Campaign Group for Women's Scotland will be heard, and we can hear more from our Scotland correspondent, Lorna Gordon. Just tell us more about how this case has come about, Lorna.
Yeah, Julian, as you say, it's been a long-running legal battle traced back to this act in 2018. That law's definition of women included people who were living as a woman or currently or proposing to undergo gender reassignment process. It was challenged by Four Women Scotland, whose position is that sex is a biological fact. They won in the courts, but the Scottish Government then amended the bill and there was a fresh judicial review. That time around, the Scottish Government won and the court ruled that sex was not limited to biological or birth sex, but also included those in possession of a gender recognition certificate. So, as you say, it's now ended up in the Supreme Court for a definitive ruling, five judges having to decide what, in effect, when it comes to the law, is a woman. Now, Four Women Scotland say that if the Scottish Government definition holds, it'll have far-reaching consequences for single-sex spaces like shelters, lesbian gatherings, sports events, hospital wards. The Scottish Government says the law is clear in this area. Transgender campaigners say that if Four Women Scotland win in their appeal, it could erode the protections they have under their reassigned gender. So strong feelings on all sides, but everyone actually hoping for a definitive ruling by judges in this two-day hearing, which gets underway tomorrow.
As you say, contentious everywhere, but perhaps particularly so in the context of Scottish politics?
Yeah, absolutely. There's been a high-profile debate in Scotland where I think it's fair to say that the theoretical has become quite tangible. It started with Isla Bryson, who was a transgender double rapist who was initially remanded to a women's prison. The then First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, struggled to state whether or not, in her opinion, Isla Bryson was a woman. There was the Gender Recognition Reform Bill, where a large majority of MSPs backed streamlining the process by which someone could get a gender recognition certificate, essentially bringing in self-identification. That, of course, was then blocked by the UK government, which claimed it would significantly impact on the Equality Act. That's the act that's going to be debated at the Supreme Court. I mean, politicians, I think it's fair to say, have tried to steer clear of it, and it's now fallen to the court, to the judges, to adjudicate and give it a definitive decision.
Lorna, thank you very much. Well, to consider what's at stake for the two sides here, I've been speaking to Susan Smith, co-director of Four Women Scotland, which has brought the case, and to Emily Chung, who is co-convener of Out for Independence, the official LGBTQ plus wing of the Scottish National Party. To Susan first, what did she fear would happen if the Supreme Court rejected her position?
If we were to lose, then the definition of sex and the definition of men and women would be dependent on whether or not somebody had one of these certificates. And this has implications, obviously, for women and the operation of single-sex spaces. It would have implications for how, for example, we run prisons. We've already seen some male prisoners being sent to female prisoners, some incredibly violent. What happened in Ireland was that when a version of self-ID was passed and prisoners got hold of GRCs really easily, they were able to take the Irish government to court for breaching their human rights because they were legally female and they were being placed in a male jail. So they had to move some of these incredibly violent people into female prisons. So that's one social aspect. But there's also issues for, we've got interventions from gay and lesbian associations, because associations are not covered by exceptions. There are exceptions in the Equality Act which do make some allowance for excluding people with a GRC, but associations are not covered by that. And our lesbian colleagues are really worried that going forward, they're going to have to accept a lot of men into these groups. And there are, unfortunately, quite a lot of men who do want, for whatever reason, to identify as lesbians. It used to be a Bernard Manning joke, but unfortunately now for a lot of these women, they say it's fast becoming a reality.
The accusation that will come your way, you know this very well, is that you are anti-trans in the stance that you're taking here. How would you respond to that?
I think our organisation and this action is about women. It's about being pro-women and it's about protecting women's rights, which, you know, it's taken us a very long time to get to this point. And it's taken our gay and lesbian colleagues a very long time to get to this point where sexuality was recognised under the Equality Act. If we lose, sex and sexuality are both rewritten in law and we lose a lot of the rights we've enjoyed. So I suppose you can only characterise us as being anti-trans if you think that women and gay and lesbian people having their rights protected by law is somehow problematic.
Can the two go hand in hand? Can you be...
Absolutely.
Well, that seems to be a significant problem by law in this country at the moment. So how would you end up in a situation where the two do go hand in hand?
Well, for the most part, people do not need to be segregated by sex or segregated by their sexuality or by their race or anything else. The law is there to protect people in the instances where that really, really matters, where they need access. For example, women need access to a rape crisis shelter, or where you're in hospital and you need care for a sex-specific condition. And also you need perhaps research done on how a heart attack affects a man and a woman differently. All these things are dependent on sex. So it's quite important we have crystal clear definitions of this. So generally, there shouldn't be a problem. And there are all sorts of ways that we can protect every group individually and separately and cater for their needs. What this is about really is about people wanting to ensure that women no longer have the right to access to spaces and services. And that to me doesn't seem terribly progressive. That seems like a very regressive thing to do. It's something a few years ago, I think people would have been shouting it down as some of the worst excesses of misogyny or the kind of incel movement.
Susan Smith from For Women Scotland. Well, now to Emily Chung, who rejects the reasons for the appeal and who represents LGBTQ plus people in the Scottish National Party.
Our objection is that we think the decisions made by the Supreme Court at the moment have actually been very appropriate. There's a focus on the realistic day-to-day application of the law that we feel is very, very helpful for actually when this law will be used. So, for instance, this is in reference to particularly affirmative action plans. And ultimately, whilst we can talk about kind of the specifics and the abstracts, in the realistic day-to-day when this will be used, in the vast majority of cases, it winds up just making sense to include trans women in the overall classification of women for these purposes.
That's where the difference lies, isn't it? Because FWS would say that, of course, we should see rights enshrined in law for trans women. But they argue that these rights should be protected in legislation separate from biological women's rights. Now, why do you resist that?
I think the best way to explain this is with an example. So say you're running one of these affirmative action plans. So you have, say, a board and you're looking to get 50% women. And you have an applicant who walks in. Let's call her Jane Doe. She has long hair. She uses she, her pronouns. She's called Jane. She's maybe dressed quite femininely. In those situations, socially, you're not really going to be doing any of the tests that would distinguish a trans woman from a non-trans woman. So it wouldn't make sense to include them as separate.
Can I extend the boardroom analogy, though? Because FWS have done this. They say that if this hearing goes in the direction that you would like it to go to, you could end up conceivably with a public board comprising 50% men and 50% women with certificates who were born male. And they question what that does for gender equality.
To be honest, I think it's astonishingly unlikely.
It is astonishingly unlikely. I acknowledge that. But under this situation that you are legally pushing towards, that could happen, couldn't it?
Yes, but I don't feel that would defeat the purpose. Trans women socially live as women for the vast majority of situations. My understanding of their objection is that it would lead there to be only a male perspective in the boardroom, but that, to be honest, kind of avoids the lived experiences of trans women. Being a trans woman fundamentally changes your experience. For example, if we take one of the common reasons why, for instance, people ask for more women in the boardroom is a greater level of sensitivity towards, for instance, pregnancy leave, maternity leave. You know, obviously trans women can't get pregnant, but they do often have to have extensive medical interventions. So they're more likely to be sympathetic to that.
For Women Scotland talks about the wider potential ramifications of this hearing if it goes in the direction that you would like it to go to. And they raise the issue of who can access single-sex services, certain protected spaces, which is obviously a well-explored area. They have concerns about that. Why do you say they shouldn't have concerns about that?
There's two concerns. The first is a practical matter, is that they oppose it on the grounds of they feel that gender identity, gender recognition certificates, rather, shouldn't grant access to single-sex spaces. The answer is that they don't. The second argument is, again, somewhat of a sad one, which is that there is a presumption in the Forum in Scotland's argument that same-sex or single-sex female spaces in particular are free of physical and sexual violence. And sadly, that's simply not true. Sadly, biological women, cis women, can and do commit horrible acts of violence, including sexual violence, including rape, on other biological cis women.
Emily Chung from Out for Independence on tomorrow's Supreme Court hearing on the legal definition of a woman. Our target must be to enable Ukraine to act out of a position of strength, the words of Boris Pistorius, Germany's defence minister, after he met his counterparts from Britain, France, Italy and Poland in Berlin today. The message from the meeting was that European countries will step up their support to strengthen Ukraine's defence industry as winter approaches. Ever since Vladimir Putin threatened that Russia would respond to any escalation of support for Ukraine with rocket attacks on its Western allies, Poland has been one of the loudest voices insisting that Kiev has every right to launch missiles at Russia itself in self-defence. But Poland is home to several US military facilities, including one that Russian officials have identified as a possible target should the war escalate. Our Eastern Europe correspondent, Sarah Rainsford, has this report.
There were celebrations in northern Poland this month as the ribbons were cut and flags raised at an American missile defense base. As Poland's president pointed out, the base was first planned when NATO was most worried about ballistic missiles from Iran or North Korea. Those were the days of George Bush and his axis of evil. Now it is Russia that's threatening to attack the West after Ukraine's allies supplied Kyiv with rockets that are hitting Russia. Vladimir Putin has warned he has the right to hit any military facility of those countries. And the foreign ministry spokeswoman has been pretty specific. Maria Zakharova said the new American base in Poland could be a priority target for Russia's newest missiles. So I headed for Rzeczkowa to see how people there were taking the threats.
There's a small yellow concrete chapel here, just next to the green fence and the barbed wire of the military base. The bells are ringing and there's quite a crowd of people heading now towards the main morning mass.
Regina told me she and her family were worried. It's all they're talking about, she says. But Joachim was clear. There is no way Putin would attack the United States here, he told me. It would be suicide.
Standing looking through this barbed wire and the fencing towards the American base here, it is extraordinary to think that relations with Russia are so hostile now that officials in Moscow can openly talk about targeting sites like this. But that's what Moscow wants. It wants the West to worry about just how far it could escalate things. And yet here in Poland, they've been living with the idea of Russia as a threat for a very long time now.
And Poland has suffered a lot from the Soviet times and from Russian imperialism. And Putin, as our neighbour, has been really sending threats to the entire region for a while already.
Back in Warsaw, I met Aleksandra Wiśniewska, an MP with the governing coalition. She's been to eastern Ukraine herself, delivering aid from Poland, and she is sure that the West has to go on helping Kyiv, whatever the warnings from Vladimir Putin.
We cannot right now sacrifice the fate of Ukraine, which is in desperate need, you know, of more military support, of increased humanitarian support.
Do you think that the West should continue to respond and to escalate its support for Ukraine, given that Vladimir Putin makes such open threats that he won't allow that?
What he's currently saying, you know, is not credible. I think that if we were to appease him in any way, shape or form, that would only strengthen the Russian aggression.
Poland, though, believes it's already under attack. Not with rockets, but with actions meant to destabilise as well as cause damage.
This was a giant shopping mall and it's now just a few heaps of bricks and rubbish and a couple of charred black walls. It is pretty strange looking at it to think that this fire could somehow be linked to Russia, but that is what the authorities are investigating, and not just here, but acts of arson and sabotage right across the country, and they describe it as part of a hybrid Russian war.
When I ask a group of pensioners sheltering from the icy wind whether they're worried about Russian missile attacks, this lady just laughs. She tells me Putin's not the only one with rockets. But from the ruins of the shopping mall behind her, it seems like Russia's hybrid war on Europe has already escalated.
Sarah Rainsford reporting. Well, on the Russian side of the conflict in Ukraine, new faces are appearing on the front line, many of them from outside Russia. Much of the focus has been on the 12,000 North Korean regular army troops fighting against Ukrainian forces in the province of Kursk. But there have been reports of mercenaries joining the Russian side from Nepal and India. And now hundreds of men from Yemen have gone to Moscow, raising questions about the growing links between the Russians and the Iranian-backed Houthi rebel group. Charles Clover of the Financial Times has written about what he calls a shadowy trafficking operation. He told me how these Yemenis ended up on the battlefield.
Well, the Yemenis signed contracts with a dodgy company that was promising them high paid work and eventual Russian citizenship. They got on planes, and as soon as they arrived in Moscow, they were handed enlistment contracts and forced to join the Russian army, which they weren't expecting, or they say they weren't expecting. We're talking hundreds of Yemenis either duped in this way into joining, or some of them probably knew what they were getting into and had fighting experience and wanted to be mercenaries. But the people that I talked to didn't, and I spoke to one who's still in Ukraine, and he has since been injured. And then I spoke to another one who's managed to pull some strings and get on a flight back to Oman and to Yemen.
So many of these will have been forced onto the front line, will they?
They say many of their colleagues have been killed. So they clearly are involved in fighting. The one that I spoke to who's still there, he was building a bunker. So it's possible that they're being employed in kind of construction brigades and things like that. But they're clearly very close to the fighting. We've exchanged voice messages and things, and you could hear drones and firing when they were communicating.
You talked about the process whereby they go in the first place. I mean, and a company's involved. Money, therefore, has changed hands. We know that, do we?
It seems that some of them actually paid money to a company. I wasn't able to confirm that. But I think there's really the most important element here is actually the politics, because the company itself that was trafficking them is connected to the Houthis. Recently, Russia has taken an interest in the Houthis because, I guess, the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And the Houthis have been trying to make friends with Russia, hoping for weapons and support. And this seems to be part of the way the Houthis are trying to be useful to Russia, is to send them soldiers.
Charles Clover of the Financial Times. Online petitions requiring a government response and even a parliamentary debate date back to Tony Blair's government in 2006. But it was under the Conservative Liberal Democrat coalition that they developed along the lines that are still familiar today, whereby British citizens and UK residents can set a petition up on almost any subject and wait for the signatures to mount up. Sometimes they do, often they don't. Well, one that's made the headlines in recent days has gathered almost 2.5 million signatures. It accuses the new Labour government of breaking its promises and calls for a new election. Keir Starmer says he's not worried, but should he be? Scarlett Maguire is a director of the pollsters JL Partners. Lucy Fisher is Whitehall editor at the Financial Times and host of the FT's Political Fix podcast. Good evening to both of you. To Lucy, first of all, you're at Westminster. How much worry is there, if any?
Well, look, I think many people in Westminster are very familiar with these petitions. Once they gather 10,000 signatures, they get a response from the government, although bear in mind that is usually a fairly cursory response. And ones that gather over 100,000 names will be considered for a debate in Parliament. I think it has struck people how much this particular petition has gained momentum on social media. It has been promoted by Conservative front benches, by the Reform UK leader Nigel Farage. Even Elon Musk, the owner of the social media platform X, has drawn attention to it. Is the government quaking in its boots over this? No. And I wasn't surprised to see sort of Keir Starmer brush it off this morning on a broadcast interview, and also make clear that, you know, he views this as people who didn't want Labour elected in the first place kicking up a fuss. But for all that, you know, 2 million signatures does make it the third most signed petition since this sort of new rule about petitions was introduced in 2010. So it is also remarkable on that front.
So, Scarlett, what does it tell us about public attitudes to the government?
I think the petition itself is a bit of a gimmick. No doubt signatures will continue to be added to it. But I think where it does make for slightly queasier reading for Downing Street is in the context of all the other public opinion research we do have, and as a sort of data point that is in tune with a backdrop of public opinion, which is sort of remarkably bad, actually, for a new government, especially a new government elected with a landslide majority of MPs. And I do think, especially when you look at Keir Starmer's own vertiginous drops with his approval ratings, with the Labour Party's approval ratings also, and then also views about how the government is handling certain issues, how people feel the budget went. And none of it makes for particularly optimistic viewing for the Labour Party.
I mean, he's saying he's doing all the unpopular stuff early and that this will change.
Yes, I think they are saying that. I think when they came in, I'm sure they expected they would have to land an unpopular budget. I think how bad the backdrop of public opinion and the unpopularity they had achieved before they even announced the unpopular measures in the budget, I think, has potentially taken them a bit by surprise.
Lucy, you used the word queasiness with reference to Downing Street a moment ago. I mean, is there queasiness on the Labour backbenches to any degree when they see something like this?
I think it's not so much this petition alone, as Scarlett pointed out. You know, the way that the budget has landed, the rockiness of the first few months of government. You know, they've barely been in office 5 months, and there have been a lot of teething problems. There's been a lack of pace. There's been a lack of political nous, which started with Rachel Reeves sort of needlessly perhaps expending political capital in the way she rolled out changes to the winter fuel allowance, which many Labour MPs tell me they are still receiving, you know, many letters and emails about it each week. So I think it's taken together, along with the sort of the backbiting and negative briefing inside Downing Street that led to a big kind of overhaul of personnel, you know, topped with Sue Gray, the Prime Minister's chief of staff, no less, exiting last month. It's just, you know, put together creates a picture of a new administration that's, you know, taken some time to find its feet.
Scarlett, this petition process, I gave a sort of very brief history of it. I mean, does it really achieve a great deal for people?
I don't think it does, actually. And I think, especially when it comes to petitions like this, as I said, they're a bit of a gimmick. And I think ultimately a waste of parliamentary time, which is quite precious and which already has sort of an awful lot for MPs to deal with and to get through to the country's problems. So, no, I'm not sure it is a sort of effective way, although it is. It's one way that people have to register their unhappiness with the current situation. And just picking up on what Lucy was just talking about there, I think absolutely right to highlight the winter fuel cut, the cuts of winter fuel cut payments. I think that has been disastrous for the Labour Party, and we're now seeing a situation with pensioners which is almost Corbyn-like in how bad it looks.
Scarlett Maguire, Lucy Fisher, thank you both very much indeed. It's 40 years since this single was released, a month after Michael Burke's iconic news report showing what he described as the biblical famine in Ethiopia. Band-Aid and Do They Know It's Christmas? Well, today, 40 years after the original, a remake has been unveiled, which merges together vocals from three different versions of the single released across the decades. It reminds people of a remarkable fundraising initiative, but the idea isn't without its critics. Ed Sheeran, who contributed to the 2014 version, said that if asked, he'd have respectfully declined to have his vocals reused. This, as others have questioned the depiction of Africa in the project and the role of foreign aid. Well, the veteran music producer Trevor Horn was involved in the original Band-Aid recording back in 1984 and has produced this new ultimate mix. He told me how the idea began, and the Bob here is, yes, Sir Bob Geldof.
When Bob called me and said, I want you to do the
the big mix, a mega mix of three different versions of the record. I was taken aback because he caught me in the middle of lunch. I listened to the three versions, you know, 84, 2004 and 2014, and I more or less decided straight away to use the original because I thought the original had something. But I mean, the first thing I thought was I need to change the intro so people know it's a different record. And I thought there was something very sad about it, you know, especially after I watched the Michael Burke film. So I changed the chords on the intro to make it feel sadder. And I thought I got to start off with Paul Young because he's got such a wonderful voice, that guy.
It's Christmas time and there's no need to be afraid.
And then following him with Chris Martin.
It's Christmas time, there's no need to be afraid.
I thought it sounded beautiful. I was really pleased with this.
Talk to me about some of the doubting voices that you have heard, and I know you've heard them on this project. Ed Sheeran said, if asked, he'd have respectfully declined to have his vocal reused because he was on the 2014 version.
Yes, he was, yeah.
The British Ghanaian rapper Fuse ODG saying that initiatives like this perpetuate the idea that Africa is plagued by famine and poverty, which is not the truth, he says. How do you respond to those?
Honestly, it never occurred to me that somebody wouldn't want their voice on it. And if Ed had called me up and said, I don't want to be on it, I would have taken him straight off. He's only on one line. I could have used somebody else doing it. I've got a lot of respect for Ed Sheeran, you know. Anybody who can fill Wembley Stadium just on his own and play just on his own has got to command my respect.
I suppose the question it raises, wherever the reservations come from, is whether over the last 40 years, so much has changed, so many attitudes have changed, that while the issues being discussed here are vital, of course, it's about how they're put into the public's mind and how you want the public to react to them. That has changed in that time, hasn't it?
Well, I think certain parts of the public have changed in the way they react to these things. But, you know, if you see what they actually do with Band-Aid, every week they're sending money to schools, to orphanages, to all kinds of places. And, you know, it's all very well to criticize something while you're not in there, you're not over there. But, you know, I ask the people that get the money what they think about it.
Music producer Trevor Horn. And that is The World Tonight. This is Julian Morica for now. From me and everyone on the programme, have a very good night.